Thank you, Mike.
Okay, so I guess we'll just jump right into this, huh? Okay, so I'm a basic scientist in the neuro-oncology department. We've been working mostly towards developing new therapeutics for brain tumors that we tried to generate out of our lab here at Roswell to directly impact in the clinics here. Most of our stuff has been focused on immunotherapy. One in particular is a peptide vaccine that's now in phase two clinical trials at Roswell and five other sites around the country. So we're having pretty good luck with that. And what I wanted to do is just kind of go through the general way that you would bring something from the lab to the clinic, dance around a few of the pitfalls that we've smacked straight into along the way, and go over a little bit of the clinical data that we've generated, and go over some of the things that have spawned out of that clinical data. A lot of times people will think that as you spawn from basic research to clinical research, you kind of go through the trial, get your numbers out of it, and that's that. But there's an enormous amount of stuff that we can learn from the patients as we're delivering the vaccines and other treatments to them, just in byproducts that we may find that we didn't think were important as part of the immune response turn out to be way more important than we ever thought there was, different characteristics and different molecular features of the patients that affect their survival. All sorts of different stuff. So let's get right into this. Technically, I have to put a quick disclosure up because I have one foot on the dark side with Mimivax and one side on the academic side with Roswell. So here's what we want to go over is just translational science. So I've broken this talk into four pieces. First, we'll just go through some basic translational development, move on to the CervaxM vaccine, which is the vaccine here at Roswell. Some of the current clinical data, and then what we've learned from it along the way. Yeah. Okay, so the reality between bench to bedside translation is really that it's much more of an abyss. It's nothing simple moving from the bench, getting it into a patient. Basically, it's the process of bringing new medicines into clinical practice. The reality is that it takes an awful lot of time. It's very easy to mess it up, and this is what's usually referred to as the Valley of Death. There are thousands of drugs that are developed in the lab that just never make it to the clinic, and that was partly some of the reason why we tried to move some of ours over. We cured it in mice I don't know how many times. You see this go round and round, you publish a paper, move on to the next thing. So we took that approach that, well, you know, if we're doing it in mice, maybe we need to move this in and actually get it into a patient, see if we can do something with it. And that's what we tried to do. Moving something from concept to market will take 10 to 15 years, can cost almost $1 billion. And you got to move fast because the patent life is only 25 years. So you're kind of on this clock to get it off to somebody that will eventually do something with it. For every drug that does get through the FDA, there's 5,000 to 10,000 that fall dead along the way. So this is the process. You know, anything starts with your basic idea, basic research, and then moves into the clinical phase. So it's a phase one trial for safety, toxicity, phase two looking for a little bit of efficacy, signals that, well, maybe this is real, phase three compares to the standard of care, and see what we can do with it to actually get it to an approval through the FDA, which is the regulatory approval hurdle. It's a very simple process, but as you get to that point between phase one and phase two, you discover there's landmines everywhere, a pathway goes up and down. It is not the simplest thing that you would think it should be. What we're trying to do is set up our own drug development pharmaceutical system here at Roswell to move things together. Reality is it turns out to look a little more like this on a day-to-day basis, and there are definitely days that it is much closer to that aspect. So, bridging basic science to clinical science. So, first thing you want to be looking to is, does your prototype agent have some sort of activity? Is what you're looking at in the lab real? Is it working in a reproducible model? Because this is going to come back to FDA studies for toxicology. They're going to want to see it work in that model under their direction. Is it a well-established model? Is this something that hundreds of people have used? Because if it's not, they're going to want to see you do it in another model that are more familiar with. Is it ready to get out? And this is the next part where a lot of people really fall short with clinical development is you have to stop tinkering with it. You know, you get a drug. This drug has to be the one that's going to move it all the way into phase 3 trials. It means you can't go back and add a different conjugate to it or different derivative, put another hydroxyl group here, change its permeability characteristics. That's it. You got to stop. You got to go with it. Then there's an aspect of preclinical manufacturing, which is another beast all its own. So you need to scale up from what you're doing in the lab. You know, it's pretty easy to make a few micrograms of any sort of proteins, DNAs in the lab, but now when you're talking about building it up into grams or kilograms, things change. It's not that simple. You need to find other sites that can do it for you. Then you have to make sure that after they've done it with their methods, that it still works the way you did it with your methods. Another biggie is that all the studies have to be GLP or GMP, good laboratory practice or good manufacturing processes. And that is critical for FDA because they won't accept anything less than that, which changes all the aspects of the experiments, changes the cost of them dramatically. What it really boils down to is that there's a massive level of record keeping going on so that the entire process is documented with standard operating procedures. Every reagent that you've incorporated and touched has also been traceable to back where it was found, where it was developed from. So if anything goes wrong along that clinical process, they can go back to those documents and figure out that one point, okay, here's what we've got to fix, and then go and fix it. But it's also designed to be a handoff process, so that if this is given off to a larger pharmaceutical or another group at some point, they should be able to replicate your data just by going through the SOPs and the GMP documents that they've been provided. Everything is nailed down. And then you usually end up going right back to the top and starting over again. Yeah. So the first part of getting into the clinic is this investigational new drug application. It's an application to the FDA to seek permission to test a drug or a biologic in humans. It's basically your license to do clinical trials. FDA works a little funny, though. So to do an IND, which is a multi-thousand page document describing what you're putting together, you're given 3 pre-IND meetings to discuss your format and what needs to go into it. Then the fun part is that the FDA doesn't answer questions. You pose questions to the FDA, and they will tell you yes or no. So you can pose to them, should I be doing toxicology in a rat model? They'll say no. Then it's up to you to come up with, well, what should I be doing? They won't give you direct advice as to what you should do, so they can't influence your studies, and this is how they go about doing that. So then you'll propose, well, can I do it in the mouse efficacy model that I developed the drug in? Yes. And then they'll start telling you parameters that you want to do, you know, a low dose, a high dose, bracketed doses, time frames, all that kind of stuff, and they'll start spewing that out. But you kind of have to tease this out of them, and they won't come right out and tell you anything that you need to incorporate without you first asking about it. The other part of the IND is chemistry, manufacturing, controls. This is all of the manufacturing, all the GLP, GMP documents for everything that you've synthesized. So that's the main part. The second part is the clinical trials document. So this is what the protocol for the trial actually is. This is what goes to the Institute Review Board, gets approved, allows you to treat patients. And then the pharm tox is the third section. This is all the animal work, PK, PD studies, animal toxicology. So they want to see all that. But what they're really, really after of all of this is safety and drug stability. Those are the two main things they look for in the IND going to phase 1. They will not even ask you if the drug has any efficacy. They do not care at that point. All they're concerned about is that you're not going to hurt somebody with it. And that's the whole aspect of the IND and especially the phase 1 trial. So they'll look at drug stability, purity, deals with the GMP process a bit, and then safety. Usually when you do toxicology studies, they'll also want to see it in 2 different species. It depends on the drug and how it works out. So sometimes it's mice and rats, sometimes it's mice and dogs, sometimes it's dogs and monkeys. The IND itself is a living document. Everything you do from this point forward with that drug gets added to that IND in a yearly addendum from now until the end of time. So it starts with about 2,000 pages, ends up in a gazillion pages. The format's usually up to the investigator. There's no defined format aside from including those 3 parts, CMC, toxicology, and pharm tox. So it's kind of a hodgepodge. But everything's got to be in there, and they will check. They check once a year to see if you've added anything. This includes all your preclinical data. So if you're doing stuff with it in the lab that, it wasn't clinical research. I didn't think it needed to be in there. They want that in there, too, because that could signal some sort of toxic effect in some system that will come down the road. And most important, the FDA really does establish the point that they don't have to approve anything. You can submit documents to them, and they'll send them right back to you. And you can go through that process 7 or 8 times before anything even starts to happen. So it's submitted. Then they start what they call a countdown clock. And this is kind of the interesting thing. They have 30 days once you submit this multi-thousand page document to them to review it and say you can go ahead on your trial. Honestly, I don't even see how they read it in that time frame, but they do. They usually will ask for minor clarifications or documents. And they have a notorious tendency to come back to you on day 28, 29 to put you on a clinical hold and ask for modifications to the document. But if you don't hear anything for 30 days, that's your green light. They don't come back and say, go ahead. You just get to go and start your trial, which is kind of an interesting aspect. So if you don't hear anything, it's good to go. So jumping through that part, now I want to get into actually a little more meat of it, which is the CervaxM vaccine and how that was developed and the process we went through with that. So a little bit of the history of this. So we were studying survivin, inhibitor of apoptosis protein pathways in the lab, mostly looking at them as prognostic markers for glioblastoma. We eventually discovered that we could target it using immunotherapy. And since we had a lab, so half of my lab is I'm doing the basic science, and then Dr. Fenstermaker is the neurosurgeon. He's the other half of the lab. So we kind of had this partnership going on. So it kind of made sense to easily translate something from basic science right out to his clinic, and that's what our goal was. So we followed this bench-to-bedside model. We broke off our company Mimivax from Roswell in 2012, so it's a spin-off company, which means it sits in another building next to the institute, still doing all the same thing that we're doing in the regular labs. Filed our IND in 2013 and started our phase 1 study at that point, got through that. Started a phase 2 study in 2015, which is now just starting to have its readout in 2018. And we're looking and learning different things from that, and even the trial has taught us that there's a CAR-T target that was developed through our vaccine that we can start to capitalize on. So that's what I mean, you start to learn things from the trial. So glioblastoma, very high unmet medical need, 15,000 cases a year, and less than 3% of those are going to survive 5 years. This is a pretty ugly disease, very poor prognosis, very difficult management, high morbidity. The last FDA-approved drug was temozolomide, Temodar, and that was in 2005. And that increased survival by 2 months. Recently, a new device called Tumor Treating Fields was approved last year, which increased survival by another 6 weeks. And this one is it's a battery pack that you wear on your back, about the size of a car battery. You have to shave your head and wear an electrode array on your head 22 hours a day. It's not going over so well with patients. So there's a lot of looking for alternative therapies, something that could be a little better. Immunotherapy definitely fits that bill. The big thing about immunotherapy and glioma is that glioma failure comes from residual microscopic disease and not metastases. Brain tumors don't metastasize. So what they will die of is local invasion and recurrence of the tumor. Just keeps coming back, and it's not like you can cut out more brain to make room for this thing. So eventually it will come back and be the end of the patient. And a funny thing that happens is that when you take a glioblastoma out, the immunosuppression that's usually associated with cancer temporarily goes away, and the patient's immune systems fire back up. That's mostly because the tumor is secreting immunosuppressive enzymes and all sorts of targets messing with the immune system. You take that out, you get a good immune response going. And what we've tried to do is build this into standard therapy. So patients will have that tumor resected, and our goal is to move the vaccine into that window right after the tumor's been resected, and we have a chance of getting a better overall immune response. The target is survivin. a unique antigen inhibitor of apoptosis. So it's in the P53 pathway, stops cells from apoptosing. It's an intracellular protein, mostly, with very complex functions. So it's in the P53 pathway, but it's also involved in chromatin segregation. It's in the mitochondria. It's in the cytoplasm. It's shuttling proteins around. It's doing an awful lot for a very small protein that it is. It is associated with a poorer prognosis. Patients that have high survivin expression have a worse prognosis. There's several different isoforms of this, which is kind of an interesting thing for some of these proteins. There's a wild-type survivin, but then there's seven alternate transcripts that are all actively translated into proteins. Some of these are missing their carboxy tail. Some of them have different insertions. And what's interesting is that all these different isomers will dimerize into different forms. So it's kind of plug and play like Legos doing different sorts of actions. The downside is we have no idea what any of those are actually doing aside from inhibiting apoptosis, which seems pretty weak. So we designed a peptide vaccine around survivin, looking at desirable characteristics of what we'd want to incorporate into an immunotherapy peptide. Obviously, unique expressed antigen is good. Survivin's tumor-specific. Technically, it's an oncofetal protein, so it's involved in development. And it's usually turned off shortly after birth or early childhood, and has very limited adult expression. And this is what's gotten us so far to being a unique vaccine, is that you want it to be a natural high-affinity antigen. And what I mean by that is that high-affinity autoreactive T cells are usually wiped out of your body during development. Your body doesn't like to have T cells that can react to normal tissues and liquefy things on you. So it has a way of developing central tolerance to get rid of those T cells. So what we do is we engineer another antigen into a high-affinity immunogen. So we have a mimic of the survivin protein that triggers a lower-affinity T cell, which is cross-reactive to the wild-type survivin peptide displayed by tumors. So what we're doing is essentially triggering autoimmunity through an alternate pathway. We did this with a homologous model, so having a mouse model that expresses the target is pretty helpful. And what we did is we tried to optimize the immune response. Many vaccines and immunotherapies will go after trying to develop a CD8 T cell response or an antibody response exclusively. Thing is, all these arms of the immune system support and regulate each other. So if there's a way that you can stimulate a response that will incorporate CD8, CD4, and antibody all at the same time, it generates a much stronger response, and that's what we've learned through the vaccine. And then try it out with glioblastoma, because nothing could possibly go wrong there. So it's a criticism we've taken for the company, but we're from a neuro-oncology background, so we had to start somewhere. Most people don't like to launch out in phase 1 trials in glioblastoma, because it's a pretty rough field to even try to do anything with. What is it? Okay, so this is kind of a graphic of what I mean by mid-affinity and self-proteins. A normal T cell will not recognize a lot of self-proteins expressed on a tumor cell. But if it's a altered peptide, different peptide, another T cell can pick up on that, recognize it, and activate, and then that T cell, if it's cross-reactive to the original wild-type antigen, can then jump over and kill tumor cells through that mechanism. So a little more detail of that is what I mean by high-affinity T cell receptors are that they respond directly to the wild-type antigen. As I said before, those are usually deleted during birth or early development, but these mid-affinity T cell receptors still hang out. They're not activated. Your body has a number of T cells that are there from birth until death that are just never turned on. A lot of these are related to autoimmune diseases. Viruses have ways of triggering these things. Lupus, MS basically work in this mechanism. So what you do is take that antigen that's a little different and use that to trigger that T cell receptor. And then if you're lucky, that T cell receptor will respond to the wild type as well. You got to make sure not to over-engineer it, because you can change too many things, still trigger immunity to the T-cell receptor, but then that thing has got nothing to do with the original wild-type antigen, so it's not going to be an effective response. So then we went into what I like to call reverse immunology. You can predict how a peptide will technically respond in the immune system by its MHC binding characteristics, size, and different amino acids. What we did is we used a murine intracranial glioma model. So we implant tumor cells in a mouse. This is a tight model where almost all the mice will die about 20 days after being implanted. So we vaccinated them with a large chunk of the survivin molecule, see if we can get any response to this thing at all. So this is like 140 amino acids. We get a decent little response out of it. From that, we then broke up individual T-cell epitopes, little 9 amino acid portions, and changed around different amino acids to see how that would affect immunogenicity. Some did pretty good, some did much better, but it's important to remember that if you change it different characteristics, you can go the other way. So you can completely eliminate the immune response that you're after. This is something that's coming up a lot with neoantigens right now that you hear for personalized vaccine, neoantigen vaccines, where they're looking for mutations in cancer patients. We'll develop a vaccine to random mutations. The problem you get into there is that just because you have a mutated protein doesn't mean that that's going to trigger any sort of immune response. And in fact, it can actually make it worse. Just something that's not getting a lot of attention. Responses can vary. So we took these as 9 MERS and then built them out into 10, 11, 12 MERS, added more CD8 T cell epitopes to it, and we started to get much better responses. Took it a little further and added a CD4 epitope into it, and now we've got good responses and about 30-40% cures with the vaccine in intracranial mice. This is a control mouse, a giant tumor. That's a vaccinated mouse, really nothing there but a little bit of a scar. This is the vaccine that eventually became the Cervaxm that's used in patients now. This is the kind of diagram of the peptide and what's in it. So each of these brackets represent CD8 T cell epitopes that are built into the single 15 mer peptide. So its overlapping pieces are carved out and chewed up by the immune system and presented and triggered as a different CD8 epitope. So you get 6-7 different CD8 clones coming off the same peptide. And then the whole thing fits into the MHC class 2 cleft of a CD4 T-cell response, triggers the CD4 cells, which give cytokine support, growth factors, which help keep all of the CD8s off and growing. Usually a CD8 response will flare up after immune response, but if there's no CD4s around to support it, then it peters out and goes away. And then the whole thing will also produce an antibody. We'll get to that in a couple other slides. This is what we did to it. We changed just a couple of amino acids around, which change a portion of the molecule, but it retains its overall secondary structure almost entirely, which when you build that towards an HLA response, this is how strong a peptide binds to MHC class 1, how likely it is to trigger a CD8 T-cell response. The wild-type survivin only binds about 1%. The modified one is over 130-fold stronger than that. And that's why it gets a strong immune response. Here we're looking at tissues that express survivin that are candidates for the vaccine. We are looking at glioblastoma, but it's expressed in over 90% of other cancers. It's in renal carcinomas, adenocarcinomas, teratomas even, melanomas, but it's not expressed in normal tissues. So we've got a good safety window, tumor specificity. This is the vaccine itself, just the characteristics of it. It is a 15 amino acid synthetic long peptide mimic. What that just means is it's a peptide that you make on a machine. We've modified amino acids and their structure. It's multivalent, so it covers several different T cell epitopes within it. So that was another graph with different brackets all over the place. So each of those chews up a piece of this, presents a different piece. It has broad HLA coverage. So every patient has their own HLA allele signature. What one patient responds to is not what another patient will respond to. The peptide's designed to float over several different HLAs to not have to be restricted. So it can bind to an HLA-02, an 03, a 24, an 11. Then it's coupled to a protein called high molecular weight keyhole limpet hemocyanin. This is a 4 megadalton protein, which is commonly used in labs for generating antibodies and carrying proteins so they don't degrade. The way it's conjugated, so there's 250 peptides attached to one molecule of this thing. So it makes a super high density antigen that dendritic cells, macrophages will pick right up on as a danger signal. That carries your peptide through to be immunized against. Activates the mid-affinity T-cell receptor, stimulates multiple CD8 cells and the CD4, and also generates antibody. And this is the cool thing about a vaccine. So it's given as a cell-free systemic subcutaneous injection. It's emulsified in montanide, which is kind of like a toothpaste-like oily goo, which helps keep it localized and stable a little bit longer in the body. It's given with some GM-CSF, which helps attract dendritic cells, mature them, a little more feeding factor. Patients come in, they get 4 doses every 2 weeks and a booster every 3 months, and they go home. So it's compared to wearing a helmet and a battery pack on your head 22 hours a day, it's a pretty good trade-off. And it's low-cost, frozen, kept in the pharmacy. Then we get to keyhole limpet hemocyanin. This is kind of an interesting story on our development, which ties into the IND and the GMP and the whole reason I even introduced that stuff. So we use giant keyhole limpets, which you can extract their blood, which is actually a blue blood. They're one of the only animals that have blue blood. And that's because of this protein, which is the keyhole hemocyanin. The 4 megadalton protein that's actually visible under electron microscopy. It's so big. And it's peppered, you know, with hundreds of our peptides on it. It only grows in 2 locations, off the coast of California by San Diego and another spot in New Zealand. Why, I have no idea, but that's the only 2 spots that it comes from. So we did our IND and ran it through our 30-day review, and of course on day 29 ran smack into our clinical hold that going through our documents, FDA had discovered that the KLH that we were using was sourced from the ocean, which is not GMP compliant. So it was unknown to the manufacturers that we had putting it together, so we had lots of GMP documents, batch records, all the stuff of the vaccine going through all of its tests. Nobody got a GMP record on the KLH raw material coming in. It just kind of slipped through the cracks. Nobody picked up on it. The other trade-off is that the FDA considers something coming from the wild to not be GMP, and it can't be GMP. You're harvesting something out of the ocean. There's not a really good solution to that. So FDA comes up with 2 choices, and again, FDA doesn't really discuss this. You get a call, you sit on your conference call, and they say, we've decided that you can either resynthesize your GMP KLH vaccine, or you can test for a list that we've prepared for you of like 167 known viruses by PCR, which would take about $100,000 worth of PCR tests to see if it was good. And that's kind of shaky because you don't really know if it would, because at this point you're kind of starting to think, well, yeah, this did come out of the ocean off of San Diego, and there's sewage pipes, and, you know, what got in that thing? So now you're not even sure about it. So anyway, we did take the choice number 1 to try and resynthesize, because number 2 was just not going to happen, and, you know, we were shaky enough that we didn't know what was going on with it. We did manage to find 1 company in the world that makes aquacultured keyhole limpets. So this is just like our mouse microisolators, but they're little fish tanks, and they grow these things sterilely, microisolated. It's a clean, sustainable resource. They bring them out, bleed them, put them back in, let them grow again. But then here's the trade-off. So wild KLH is $60 a gram. The GMP KLH is now $30,000 a gram. So if you have any reason to guess why any of the new pharmaceuticals cost, you know, $100,000 a dose and drug prices are skyrocketing, it's things like this you got to keep in mind. It's not necessarily the drug company doing it. It's going to be your raw material guys coming at you. There's a whole chain of stuff that's adding up to the cost of those drugs. Good news is 1 gram of that makes about 1,000 doses of vaccine. So You don't have to get too bad in the hole there. Then there's drug stability. This is something that the FDA really pushes along with safety. They want to know the drug is stable. The reason for that is if you have toxicity down the road, you don't know if you're having toxicity because your drug's breaking down, or if it's broken down into a toxic component, or if you're showing that your trial is safe, is it safe because your drug no longer has any activity? So you're constantly monitored for drug stability. So in our case, we have to monitor every 3 months to see that everything's still intact. Luckily, KLH compounds are extremely stable. If you think about how a peptide degrades, it's usually chewed up from an amino terminus end, kind of like an exonuclease sort of approach. But if you attach that to a 4-megadalton protein, that megadalton protein is going to get chewed up way faster than your 10 amino acids are that are attached to it. So it helps protect it. Problems come in that the FDA defines how you test for stability. They like to see HPLC and mass spec. And no matter if you give them 25 other ways to look at it, they come back to, well, we'd really like to see HPLC and mass spec. And when you explain to them, we can't really do that on a 4-megadalton protein, because if you think about HPLC, you're shooting small proteins through a column looking for signals they come through. This doesn't go through a column very well. So it was interesting. Most likely our biggest stability problem has been with testing companies. As soon as we talk somebody into running this thing through their columns and their HPLC, they have then ruined most of their columns and gummed up their entire works, so they don't want to do it anymore. So now we're on our third company. Luckily, our stability data remains the same, but there are some very angry HPLC testing labs out there with us. But, I mean, the overall point is that FDA doesn't care about how you get to point A to B. You just have to find a way to get there. And with clocks ticking, money going down, all sorts of things, you need to be able to adapt very quickly once you're into some of these clinical studies. So now I'll get into clinical data, what this has actually gotten us. So phase 1, 2, and beyond. Phase 1 is your initial testing, conducting a small number of patients to determine if the drug is reasonably safe. Pretty simple. Phase 2, it's a little more intricate, but now you're trying to see if the drug has any effect. You're also still looking for safety, but you're mostly focusing on effect. You've increased your patient size, 30, maybe 300 patients, and you're looking for side effects and potential risks, but you're also looking for that signal of efficacy. And then when you get to phase 3 is where you really compare it to the current standard of care. So you can do this as a single-arm study, see if there's anything happening. If you know that, in this case, brain tumor patients would live 7 months and your patients are living 10, 12 months. So that's a good sign. You'd want to continue on to phase 3. This is the results of our phase 1 study. Very small study. We looked at 8 patients. These are recurrent glioblastoma patients. So these are patients that have had surgery, radiation, and Temodar, failed that, come back, had surgery, radiation, Temodar again, and then have come on to the vaccine because they are now out of options. There's very few effective therapies for brain tumors. It's not like there's another host of chemotherapies they go on. They usually get through standard of care, and that's about it. What we found in the study was that it was safe and tolerable. Grade 1 injection site reactions, the safety profile was similar to what you would see with the flu vaccine. Just red spots where they injected it, a little bit of irritation. We found in our patients, 7 of them produced T cells that were reactive to the tumor, but then we also found 7 produced these antibodies that were reactive to the tumor. And I'll still come back to the antibodies because that gets more interesting. And of those 7 that had an immune response, 7 also had increased overall survival, one of them even a complete response. So if the expected overall survival for everybody is 7 months, which is the darker blue lines, overall survival, we saw that those who got the vaccine made it to 1 year, 2 years, 4 or 5 years, and these guys are still with us 5.5 years later. This guy was a complete response, no tumor, no nothing. Progression increased a little bit. This is kind of one of the things you see with immunotherapy, that you don't necessarily eliminate the tumor, but you really slow down its growth pattern. Usually these would progress in about a week. we've got patients here that progressed 1 year, 2 years out. So you don't necessarily stop it, but you are slowing it. Some of the data that we derived out of it, we saw that CD4 cells would influx into the tumor. CD8 cells would follow the CD4s, and these are co-localized. These are just congruent sections. So we have CD4 and CD8s in the same place. You know, 7 of these patients produced strong antibody titers, and that really got us wondering. And then this is looking at T-cell responses. So you can take a tetramer, which has your peptide attached to it in a fluorochrome, and you can run it in flow cytometry and monitor the rate of specific T-cells to the peptide you're trying to target. So what we're showing here is just 2 of the peptides. As they work up to about 12 weeks, you see a big increase in specific T-cells, nothing to controls. Just confirms there's a T-cell response. Now we're in the phase 2 study. So this is now a multi-center trial at Roswell, Dana-Farber, Cleveland Clinic, Mass General. We moved into newly diagnosed GBM. So that I brought on the earlier slide was there's that immunosuppression reversal. So once patients are resected, we can jump in and get to that period while they're still healing up for resection and vaccinate them. And that's what we did here. So they're getting it right up front. It's a single arm study, which we can compare back to standard of care data. Same schedule, 4 doses and boosters. Right now there's 63 patients on it, and there's been 2 interim analyses done. So as you get to a bigger trial, you start to introduce interim analyses to make sure that it's going right. So you don't want to wait till the end of a 5-year trial and discover that the whole thing went south. So we'll incorporate these in maybe 1 year, 2 years, or certain triggers in the trial to decide if you should keep going and maybe get a peek at the data. So a peek we have. This is the first 30 patients that were on trial. This is a newly diagnosed glioblastoma, so it's a little different beast. Whoops. In newly diagnosed glioblastoma, 54% of patients would be expected to be progression-free at 6 months, so they have no tumor for 6 months. Those receiving the vaccine, 93% of them were tumor-free at 6 months, so huge increase in preventing progression. Overall survival of a newly diagnosed patient, you would expect 61% of patients to be around 12 months later. Right now we have 94% around, so we're doing quite well. These are the first 30 patients in, and almost every one of them has gotten to 6 months. Most of those that have progressed still have a long survival on top of that. If they progress at 10-12 months, they're still out here with us 20 months later. The overall survival for glioblastoma is about 5% at 5 years, so it's doing pretty good. We're pretty excited about it. This is looking at a Kaplan-Meier presentation of progression-free survival, just a little bit different way of looking at it, but this is how you calculate if a trial is successful or not. Here we're looking to see if at 6 months your error bars, which are your confidence interval on a clinical trial, are tight enough that you can target what you expected to target. What we did here was standard of care, 54% of patients would be progression-free at 6 months. So this is where standard of care treatment, the line would fall. The trial, we targeted 70%. Kind of arbitrarily increase that based on the number of patients you have on trial to increase your statistics. Hopefully you guessed right. So we said 16% better than standard of care, and then we hit 96%. So when you look at the confidence intervals, you want to see that they're clear of the target zones. You know, we were hoping they would be here. We beat that by another 25%. So blah, blah, blah. So what it comes down to is when you do an interim analysis, depending on if you're still recruiting patients, you could get a result like this and stop the trial, and you've got enough patients to continue forward. Another thing that's important with glioblastoma patients is a DNA repair enzyme called MGMT. This one's really important when looking at brain tumor patients because it profoundly affects their survival. If they carry a unmethylated MGMT gene, that means this gene is turned on. So you recognize unmethylated and on is a good way to go at it. If it's on, Temodar has no effect in these patients. This gene will go and reverse every DNA strand adduct that Temodar causes, and they have no effect of the drug. So there's been trials comparing unmethylated patients with and without Temodar, and there's no effect whatsoever. If it's methylated, it means it's turned off. So it can't repair DNA, and there is a response to Temodar. What that means is that patients are lumped together in the glioblastoma pool with these molecular characteristics. We're starting to sort them out that maybe there's multiple glioblastoma disease niches that need to be addressed. What's here is using what they call a nomogram. This takes a computer algorithm of patient's age, sex, Karnofsky status, extent of resection, but importantly the MGMT status, and predicts where they should survive to. So each of these dots represents a patient on trial. So of the whole population, this top row, 63% of our patients on trial would be expected to make 12 months, which fits right in line with historical data. And then, as we said, 94% of them actually did, so there's a huge increase. But when you break this down for the MGMT status, here's unmethylated MGMT and methylated MGMT. Unmethylated patients, only 56% of them would reach 12 months, but 73% of methylated active MGMT, or unactive MGMT, would reach 12 months. What we ended up seeing was that the effect of the vaccine was the same in both groups. So even though these are surviving longer, they're still getting benefit of the vaccine. But importantly, the group of patients that have no effect of chemotherapy are having a tremendous response to the vaccine. So remember, unmethylated MGMT patients have no clinically effective drugs. Temodar has no effect in an unmethylated patient, and vaccines can address those needs. Sometimes you like to look to see that your target is actually correlating to response. This is looking at the level of survivin expression versus survival, progression-free survival. And the only take-home message of that is that as patients express more survivin, they seem to be surviving longer. So there's more target for the immune system to work on. It can generate a stronger immune response, which is somewhat counterintuitive because survivin is a poor prognostic factor. So these patients should be doing much worse with the more survivin they have. In reality, they're doing much better. It's giving the immune system something more to feed onto. Then what we've learned from translating this drug. So this is the antibody story that I've thrown a couple slides here and there on. The vaccine produces anti-survivin antibodies in patients. We originally followed this as simply a biomarker for response. We see an antibody, we can do a titer on it, we can say that patient had an immune response. Great, we're done with it. But then it got us wondering, survivin's an intracellular protein. It wouldn't be accessible to an antibody. So why are these patients producing such large antibody responses? What caught us off guard was that some of the responses we saw were even being generated to other parts of the survivin molecule. So once we had started the immune response, we had what they call epitope spread, where the immune system picks up and starts making its own epitopes, kind of leaching off the antibody as a starting point and making more of them. But again, if survivin's intracellular, these antibodies shouldn't even see it. So that got us thinking that, well, let's produce some of them. So we made a bunch of hybridomas to it. So we'd have a renewable source of antibody to play with in the lab. We took one of those highest clones, so some of the slides you'll see something called 2C2. That is the surviving antibody from here. So only point from that. We started to look at exosomes. We knew that glioma patients produce exosomes that come off the tumor. These are small microvesicles. They're loaded with proteins and nucleic acids. Tumor cells like to release them into the bloodstream where they have an effect on T cells. They're very immunosuppressive. At the same time, they will take them up from other tumor cells, and there's kind of a communication network that goes on through exosome transfer, I guess. We knew that survivin was possibly related to these exosomes, that it was maybe in the exosomes. So we started looking at that in our patients. You know, what we discovered was that not only was survivin in the exosomes, but it was actually expressed on the outside of the exosomes as a target. So we started looking at this as, well, maybe this could be used as a blood test. So we looked at patient blood. As they came on trial, they had a large proportion of survivin-positive exosomes. As they're vaccinated, those exosomes disappear. And we can monitor that with the antibody that we discovered from the phase 1 trial. So another patient, same deal, doesn't go down all the way, but there's a big difference. Works the other way, too. So as patients were failing on vaccine and tumor was recurring, these exosomes would start to reappear at, you know, 8 weeks past vaccine, 10 weeks past vaccine. But then we had this patient come along who had a big flare of exosomes at 9 weeks, but all of his tests were still negative. There's no tumor progression. I don't know. Comes back eventually 25 weeks down the road, and MRI has finally caught progression on that patient. So this flare-up of exosomes, survivin-expressing exosomes, was more sensitive than an MRI, picking up a tumor bits in the bloodstream 10 weeks before we could actually visualize it on an MRI. So this is something that we're working up as a potential blood test and a way to follow tumor progression, whether it's just going to be from the vaccine to monitor the vaccine response, or if it can really measure any tumor progression remains, but it's got some potential. This is our first patient that survived 5 years, so we looked at him over his five-year period, and what we ended up seeing was that there's this yin-yang of the immune system versus tumor response. So in all that time, he's been negative by MRI, no tumor, complete response, starts up on his first entry with that level of exosomes. We vaccinate him, we kind of get this different pattern. It shifts a bit and it's kind of flared around, so we think that's what's called an immune flare. Immune response is active. And then it settles down. So there's no exosomes. There's a little bit coming back up again. They go away, comes up again, goes away. And we chart those through, and over his 5 years, there's definite periods where there's been spikes in exosomes, and then they go away. And they correlate to his antibody titers and immune response. So the stronger the antibody fired up was right at the point where the exosomes were starting to build up. And then they'd go down, antibody titers would drop, exosomes would go up, so they would follow each other, and we can monitor this over a five-year period, which is kind of cool. So we tricked the immune system with the vaccine that it wasn't supposed to respond to, but then it surprised us with this antibody. So of course, since we had an antibody in our hands and we were curious, what the hell, let's stick it into an animal and see what happens. We put it into GL261 glioma models and B16 melanoma models. This is just giving the antibody in a subcutaneous tumor model, and we find tumor rejection to a target that's supposed to be inside the cell. It shouldn't happen at all. We repeated it again in some nude tumors or nude mice, so they don't have any immune system, so there couldn't be something like ADCC or macrophages or something leaching onto that antibody causing tumor death. This is just antibody on its own, and it's still got an effect. And we went as far as stick it into the intracranial setting and saw that the antibody was effective intracranially, not as good as the vaccine, but it was definitely a component of it. So we know this is all twisted together in some way. But it isn't surviving intracellular molecule. This doesn't make any sense. Nobody's reported it on the outside cells before, except us. So last month we put out a big paper in Clinical Cancer Research using this antibody, looking at different cells, and that there is a survivin isoform on the surface of most tumor cells, mouse and human. So what we're looking at is that maybe this isn't the wild-type survivin. Maybe it's one of these other isoforms, alternatively spliced forms. There's a lot of work to be done with that. What impact that would have on immunotherapy, most obvious being that now this thing is targetable by an antibody and potentially even a CAR T cell. So this is some immunofluorescence looking at it, just to see what it was and where it was going. Left panel are permeabilized cells, so you punch holes in them, usual type of immunofluorescence that you would do, and you pick up all the intracellular survivin. If you go ahead and don't permeabilize them, maintain the integrity of the cell membrane, and just look at the surface, you start to see this funky pattern of survivin staining. What we noticed was that, well, how was this missed? Either the antibody we're using is a conformational antibody, which we kind of know from the antigen, where I showed you before, a couple of loops to it. An antibody only picks up two or three amino acids in a particular peptide in relevance to the overall structure. So the sequence doesn't necessarily mean as much as the structure of the protein that you're trying to trigger an antibody to. So that's where that could come from. It could be attached to a protein complex on the surface of these cells. We know heat shock proteins and all that are intertwined with it, so that's got something. And really one of the big questions that I think we kind of answered was that if you're looking for an intracellular molecule, how often do you prep your cells to look at it on the surface? Almost never. Pathology is using fixed formalin sections. Those are permeabilized. Almost anything you do is going to be permeabilized, but there might be some other things to find out there. The other thing that became apparent was this weird sort of pattern. There's spots and speckles, not a true kind of surface ring that you would see. Turns out that those spots are lipid rafts. So we fraction cells and look for where survivin's expressed. And this is a light fraction of a cell fractionation. So you put it through a sugar column, and you can separate different parts of the cell based on their densities. So you can separate lipids, you can separate lipid rafts. As you move down this, things are getting heavier and smaller. So this is the cytoplasmic fractions. These are the nuclear and mitochondrial fractions where we know survivin's normally localized. But sure enough, the lipid raft portion is where we're picking up survivin with the same antibody, same characteristics. All the other ones are just proteins that are commonly associated with the lipid raft. So it kind of helps target where the lipid raft is on the sections, fractions. So we got an antibody, what's next? Of course we stick it into a CAR T cell, why not? It's an ideal situation for a CAR T to target a solid tumor, which is something we're desperately looking for right now. CAR Ts are really only effective against liquid tumors, leukemias, lymphomas. Another added layer of surface specificity is that only tumor cells seem to be putting it up on the surface. Normal cells don't put it on the surface. So if you happen to have a normal cell that does turn survivin on, it doesn't seem to be on the surface, which means the CAR Ts can't target it, the antibodies can't target it, and that tissue would be safe from toxicity, which is a good thing in this setting. CAR Ts are made from an antibody. So you take the scFv fragment of an antibody, you determine the sequence to it, build it into a CAR T receptor. This has got co-receptor CD28, CD3. It's hooked into a T cell backbone. That's transfected into human T cells, and then we could do something with them. Obviously, I wouldn't be showing it if we didn't have some activity. Three different tumor models. This is a breast carcinoma, which actually does express CD19, which is the common CAR T cells that are out there. Surviving CAR Ts are about the equivalent of that. Those with negative CD19, CD19 negative cells don't respond to a CD19 CAR T cell, but they do respond to the survivin CAR T. And then the antibody had one more thing it wanted to teach us. We combined it with CAR T cells and discovered that the antibody was able to potentiate the activity of the CAR Ts. So now we've got another layer. So the antibody can inhibit tumors in vivo, but we know in vitro it has no activity. We've done this in other dishes that didn't show that. It has no in vitro activity. These are in vitro lysis assays of T cells and antibody. It shouldn't have any more activity. It does. So it may be revealing another aspect of the mechanism of action. This is what the antibody has taught us about the overall immune response to the vaccine. The vaccine we know targets, or we know because we designed it, to target the zinc binding domain of survivin. If you can target that, you can interfere with its ability to dimerize and its functional abilities. We thought it was a cool target for T cells at the time to be processed and put out an MHC. We didn't think we would have an antibody that can go in and directly interfere with it, kind of like a small molecule inhibition. So this is taking it out of the realm of immunology. Now you have an antibody that's acting like a small molecule inhibitor, knocking the protein structure apart. Still don't know the function of the cell surface, though. The other part of it is antibody-mediated exosome clearance. So as I mentioned before, patients have a lot of exosomes. Those exosomes go away after being vaccinated. Turns out those exosomes are immunosuppressive, and the antibody can directly bind to the exosomes and soak them up. So our theory here is that the antibody can clear the immunosuppressive shield of exosomes that are in the tumor microenvironment, which then allows the CAR T cells to get in, get a better access to the tumor. Yeah, the giant infographic of the vaccine, just summarizing all this stuff. So we know that the surviving vaccine produces a T-cell response through CD8 and CD4 T-cells, leading to kind of a standard cellular cytotoxicity attack. We know that at the same time, this thing is stimulating B-cells, leading to plasma cells, and getting CD4 support here as well. To produce IgG, you need to have what's called a class switch. So antibodies are initially always produced as an IgM. Once they engage with a CD4 cell expressing the same epitope, they will switch to producing IgG. Those antibodies are interfering directly with the tumor, either by interfering with survivin itself or clearing the survivin-positive exosomes, allowing the cellular cytotoxicity to take a better hold. So the overall summary of everything that I put up here today, kind of six targets, and what I would take home from this would be to keep in mind what the FDA is looking for in terms of INDs. What they really want to see is safety and stability. They don't care about efficacy. They don't care about anything else. The number one thing is safety. They want to make sure your drug is stable. That's what the IND is about. That's what phase one's about. In terms of drug development, you want to keep in mind to use GMP materials and to make sure that they're GMP, even if you thought they were, which means you actually need to look at the batch records and documents that come with raw materials that you're working with. Show a little bit of the vaccine. Phase one, it's safe. Phase two, it exceeds the standard of care. This is a really important aspect of glioma that's going to become more and more involved as time goes on, and this is the molecular characteristics of subtypes of glioma. It's important to recognize that unmethylated MGMT patients are Temodar resistant. Unmethylated, no response. No response, no Temodar, keep that in mind. Unmethylated MGMT. The methylated ones are sensitive, but you keep this part straight, you'll do okay. Unmethylated or Temodar resistant. Survivin is now found on the cell surface, which makes that a potential target for monoclonal antibodies and CAR T strategies. And exosomes are these intriguing little vesicles that are secreted from tumors that are loaded with proteins and communication nucleic acids, whereas tumors can try and cause immunosuppression in the immune system, or they can interfere with growth of other cells, or there's even a seed and soil hypothesis that exosomes are the first things to land into metastases, and that's what attracts other tumor cells to it. So that's about it for me today. I'm around if you got any questions, email me later, whatever. Good luck on the exam, and thanks for staying awake.
Alright, so moving back to your antibody response. Now, there's a large body of literature that suggests, again, optimization of NK,
yep.
ADCC. Do you have that data?
Not with me, we have it. Okay. Doesn't trigger ADCC. It's a very small amount of ADCC we
that's
got.
That's surprising, but, yeah. Especially in glioblastoma.
Yeah.
It's been a pretty large area. How are you addressing long-term tolerance rate patients that eventually do relapse? Characterized that T cell before and after?
Not so much. It's mostly once they fail, things have kind of moved on, and they're going to go off to another therapy. We looked at like T cell exhaustion and that kind of thing.
Nothing else. Again, T cell exhaustion could be linked to the status of those T cells.
Yeah.
Which again might buy you another 10 years.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
Or have you looked at potential for... Okay, so that 5-year one.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out the guy relapsed after a very long time.
Right.
No expression to survive. So what you're experiencing there is epitope loss, and how do you plan to...
Well, that's where it gets interesting. So...
Like, you chose several sections of cut out. You know, dominant support.
Well, it's actually the opposite and the opposite. So that patient, we haven't seen antigen loss in the patients. So when they've recurred and we've gotten tumor samples back, target's still there. I didn't show that. So.
I thought that was what you were looking at.
No, I showed there was a... there's the exosomes. So the exosomes go down, but the tumor, recurrent tumor, still expresses target.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's still pretty recent, right? Because for the CAR T therapy, that was the first thing that literally led to their resistance to the relapse.
Yeah.
The alternative splicing mechanism. That would be
so what's
very
unique,
interesting.
What's unique here...
I can do this all day. I'm obviously an immunologist.
That's a good thing. Okay, let's see here. So what is kind of unique about what we targeted is that it's part of exon 2. And exon 2 is served in all different isoforms. So we get around that aspect of it. But the other part is that it's kind of a cryptic epitope. So that region of zinc binding is buried in the molecule. So it's a very hydrophobic zone, and it's not presented very often, which has led to why we're able to modify that. So we change amino acids around, boost its MHC binding, boost its foreignness, if you want to call it.
Define change around in detail.
So we replace these cysteines with methionines. So it's enough that it changes the overall structure, but it doesn't change the look of it.
And you conjugated that to...
Yeah, and then that's conjugated to KLH.
Which is the actual...
Mounting
against the haptin, so you're driving a large...
Yeah, so you get KLH antibodies and all that kind of jazz going at the same time.
There.
Right. So what you're kind of getting is you're getting a firing on all aspects of the immune system, which is really what seems to drive the response.
Yeah. Especially when the brain is a very suppressed and privileged environment.
Yeah.
Those patients that are relapsing might have excess MDSCs or...
Yeah.
Suppresses cell
yeah.
types.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why it's important to characterize those T cells because that's what they're changing.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
Yeah.
Good
so.
Job today. I know, like, nobody's going to really want to know this stuff, but.
You'd be surprised.